Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
Hey y'all, I'm Mandy.
And this is Monstrous.
This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering for some. Listener discretion is advised.
Okay, let's start.
So we're going to take a left turn.
We're going to take a left turn?
Yep, from our last few episodes.
Oh, God.
Veer left.
Veer left.
Okay, so we're not doing a true crime case this week. So some illegal shit happens.
Okay.
But it's not necessarily true crime.
Right.
Okay. So I figured after the last few weeks, and then before we cover next month, because May 25th is Missing Children's Day.
Right.
We need to do something a little...
lightning.
Exactly. So those are hard. We're going to do sort of like a palate cleanser. And then we'll probably do another one after those are done.
Okay. Another light one?
Yeah.
Like a light case?
Mm-hmm. So by the time this episode is over, those of you that have never flown in a plane may never fly in one.
Okay. So with all the plane crashes that's been happening lately, now the ones that got over that, you're just going to go ahead and ruin it for them again?
Yeah. Pretty much. I mean, I didn't ruin it for anybody. I didn't do it. I'm just telling you what happened.
You're just bringing it to light.
So those of you that have flown, like us, probably think twice before getting on a plane again.
You're going to make all ticket sales drop drastically. They're all going down.
So some, their fear of flying is going to get worse. And some may develop a newfound fear.
Oh, great.
But either way, all of us, by the end, will be thankful for aviation laws and development. So I'm going to tell you about Julian Kopka and her free fall to the jungle.
Oh, God.
I'm going to tell you at the very top of this, as you've already said, you're going to say, oh, my God, a lot through this. But it is a survival tale. So, no, in the end, that she does survive, but it's a long road to survival. So just keep that in the back of your head. I don't think we've covered a survival story yet.
I don't think, no.
Yeah, I don't. Not that I can think of.
I don't think we have.
I thought this was a good first one today.
Palate cleanser?
Yep. A good survival story to start on. It's so good.
I'm terrified of heights. But
well, maybe her survival will help you get over that.
I don't see how.
Just wait till the end.
Okay, we'll redirect after the end.
Okay, so I can't remember where I originally heard Julian's story from. But this one's been on our list since I made the list of cases to cover.
So for a while.
Yeah, which I have to show you those, by the way.
The binder.
Side note.
Yes.
I have to show you those.
Okay.
Anyway, I'm going to try. It's a wild story. It's fucking nuts.
I know you've been excited to tell it.
Julian's story seems like it literally comes out of a movie. It seems like a plot line to a movie rather than being real fucking life.
Right.
But it actually did happen. It's nuts. So our case today is a story of a tragedy. It's about one girl's strength, hope, and her survival. It begins on December 24th of 1971. 17-year-old Julian Kepka and her mother Maria were set to fly home from Lima, Peru to Pucallpa, I believe it's how you say it, which is a 450-mile round trip, and it was only an hour-long flight. This was a flight that both had taken before. They went back and forth. Neither were concerned. They were forced to fly on a different airline than they had originally planned. And this airline had a very long and horrific history of air disasters. In fact, the plane that Julian, Maria, and 90 other people would board was the only plane that the airline had left because every other plane had crashed.
Okay, so that's a big red fucking flag right there. I'm good. No.
Before we continue, I'm going to tell you what happens next, okay? So we have to start in October of 1954 when Julia was born. She was born in Lima, Peru to Mario and Hans Wilhelm. Originally, her father was from Germany, and her parents met when they were both in Cayel studying to earn doctorates in biology. So they were smart-ass fucking people.
Yeah.
So her parents had focused and excelled in their studies of ornithology, which is basically the study of birds. They both primarily also focused on zoology, which Maria and Hans both would go on to graduate and have careers as zoologists. Once they graduated, they wanted to live somewhere where their degrees would be helpful, obviously. So they found that Peru would be the best place. With so much of that area still unexplored and the array of diverse animals, there was nowhere better for them to begin their new lives and careers. So shortly after packing up and moving to Peru, they got married. It was very taboo at the time, okay? Because it's like the 50s. You didn't live together unless you were married. You definitely didn't move to a completely different country if you weren't married. So the whole thing is very taboo for them. Basically unheard of. For a woman to have a doctorate, especially in the field of science, even today, it's still a male-dominant field. But back then, there were no women in the field of science. Okay, then you couple this with the fact that Maria moved, like I said, with Hans to another country before they got married. It was a huge scandal. Like, who? You know, like,
oh my God.
Yeah. God forbid a woman get a doctorate and, you know, live with a man before she's married. So Julian definitely got her strength, her determination, and her will from her mom. Very clear. Why I say that, though, is because Maria herself had her own survival story, although it's different. So in 1955, Maria was forced to take a two-month excursion into the Amazon after a truck had hit a power line, which then hit Maria. Like, the power line hit Maria.
What the hell?
Mm-hmm. This caused severe injuries, including the loss of her sense of taste and smell.
Oh, shit.
This excursion isn't what she wanted to be doing. She wanted to complete her research, not take time off. So she's like, I don't give a shit if this power line just hit me. I want to be doing my research. I don't care
if I can't taste or smell anything. It's okay.
Exactly. Julian would later say that nothing could deter her mom from a goal, which would prove to be a beneficial trait because Maria published several books and pamphlets about zoology and ornithology. She had also became one of the most renowned ornithologists in Peru.
Wow.
So Maria gave no fucks, okay? She didn't care about what people around her thought or what they said she could or couldn't do. Maria slammed through the glass ceiling. And I think those are the traits that were heavily passed on to Julian. And you'll see why. Hans, her father, was much like Maria. He was a man that refused to back down. And it didn't really seem like he complained either, which that's a rare trait.
Yeah, for a man.
So he did what he wanted and did what he had to do. He was one of those, you know, it is what it is, whatever, kind of guys.
Kind of laid back.
Yeah, pretty much. Didn't really complain. It was, whatever. It is what it is.
Right.
If it's supposed to be, it's supposed to be kind of things. He also had a lot of experience under his belt, just as Maria did. Between his hard work ethic and the adventures he went on, Hans was a very knowledgeable man. Julian would say that she was very impressed by her parents and that she was in awe of them. I would love if these two people would have been my parents. And you'll get why I say that. She had an amazing childhood. I wish it was mine. So Hans, like Maria, wrote well. He wrote books about zoology and animals. One book specifically is massive. It has over 1,600 pages, and it tells you everything there is to know about every animal in the rainforest.
Damn.
Yeah. He, too, also faced his own survival and perils in his own life. So in the 40s, Hans had been offered a job in South America, but he had to make his own way there without help from whoever it was that had offered him the job. So he decided to hitchhike alone through the Alps to get there. No, thank you.
I'm good.
Yeah. No. Then later, while studying in Italy, he was kidnapped and held in a prison camp, which he was able to escape from. So her parents had very obviously built and lived amazing lives.
Right.
Full of adventure, discipline, perseverance, and passion. So shortly after the two married, Maria found out she was pregnant. Then shortly after Julianne's birth in 1951, Hans' brother, Joachim, I think that's how you say it, moved to Lima to be closer to his brother and new niece. That joy, however, was short-lived. Shortly after moving to Lima with his family, Joachim died from spasms. And from what I read, his cause of death was unknown.
Spasms, like?
I'm thinking it might have maybe been a seizure disorder that he had.
And they just didn't have that diagnosis yet?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Because I know seizures at one point, they were like, oh, he had a spasm attack and that's what killed him. So I'm wondering if that's what it was.
Yeah, that would make sense.
That's the only thing that I could think that would be considered spasms.
Right.
Maybe he's epileptic or something.
Yeah.
Following this, Hans' mother and his sister traveled to Peru to be with them. Julianne's childhood seemed to be pretty amazing. She would say that she remembered always being surrounded by animals and her family. She learned to be compassionate and hardworking early on in life from both her hardworking and compassionate parents. Julianne would help her mother nurse sick birds and care for the chicks that lived inside their home because her mother would bring in sick birds and nurse them back to health before she released them back into the wild.
Aww.
Right.
That's so cute. So sweet.
So that alone shows how caring her mom was.
Right.
And she passed that on to her daughter because she did that with her. She raised her doing that. So most people don't bat an eye at an injured animal. They have no empathy or care if an animal is hurt. And Julianne seeing her mother care for them in the way she did, I think had a lot to do with who she became later in life. So Maria, Julianne's mom, brought in hundreds of sick or injured birds. And Julianne helped her nurse each and every one of them back to health. And not a single one died under her mother's care.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That is not something I'd be able to do, let me tell you.
I can't even keep a plant alive.
I can do that. So it's clear that care and compassion were very important in their household. Her parents that, although animals were amazing creatures, they could also be dangerous. And they made sure to teach her that. They needed Julianne to know the perils that lurked within the Amazon rainforest. They taught her a love and appreciation for it, but also the vast dangers that were present as well. As young as 5 years old, they would take Julianne on hikes with them through the rainforest.
That'd be kind of cool, though.
That's what I'm saying.
I think that would be really neat.
Like, she had such an amazing childhood. Just hiking through the Amazon rainforest.
Like it's normal.
So on these hikes, they would camp in simple tents or even just sleep out in the open in only sleeping bags. Oh, that's how I grew up camping. Sleeping bags in a tent. People around here fucking have campers and shit.
Yeah, we did ours with sleeping bags and tents too on the ground.
I was like, oh, we go camping down at the river every year. That's not camping, okay?
They call that glamping. It's a glamorous camping is what they call it around here, glamping.
Get the fuck out of here with your damn bougie ass shit. It's like, that is not camping, okay?
Yeah.
If you can go in somewhere and sit on a toilet, you are not camping.
Right.
Okay, I grew up having to squat next to a tree when my grandpa looking out and make sure none of the little boys came running around.
Yep.
Had to bring on toilet paper or you used a leaf.
Yep.
But you had to check and make sure it wasn't poison ivy.
Yep, because I'm highly allergic to poison ivy. Just saying.
So like, my face blew up.
Yeah, I blow up like a balloon because
I'm allergic to it too. I'm allergic to it, but I'm not that allergic to it. I just get, like, real itchy.
Yeah, I get real bad. I have to go straight to the hospital. Mm. But I think I've outgrown it the older I've got. But also, I haven't been in the woods or anything. It used to be, like, I swear, like, I could be by the woods and the wind can just blow. And I'd swell up like a balloon and have to get rushed to the hospital.
There's a lot of people that are,
like,
that
I'm allergic really bad.
Where my grandpa lives, up there, there's a patch of, it's either poison ivy or poison oak. I can't remember, but one of the two. Grows right there in his yard. He always has to
cut it down.
He burns it.
Oh, burns it.
Yep. You put gas on it and burn it.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. He has to do that every year because it grows back every year. Yep. Which you wouldn't think it would because it's red clay. You wouldn't think it'd be able to grow, but it does. Okay. Anyway. So through those camping trips, she was taught how to survive in the harsh conditions of the rainforest. She learned what to avoid, what would help her if she was stranded or in danger. What things she could eat and what she couldn't. What things she shouldn't touch. How animals acted around humans when they were going to attack. How they acted when they were just curious about what you were doing. or just what you were, and how they behaved when they were used to being around humans. Because most wild animals are afraid of people.
Right.
They don't, like, they stay the fuck away. So she was taught from a young age how to survive and navigate the world in which she grew up in. One that very few people know anything about. And in a way, only those that truly know and understand it could do it. Her parents wanted her to always be prepared, to be able to make something out of nothing. And it is this reason that Julian is still alive today. Although it seems like her parents were just out here, you know, gallivanting and dragging their young daughter with them, they weren't. They were researching and helping the lives of the animals within the forest. And although it seems as if they had nothing because of how they lived their lives, they were actually well off financially. The family had a maid who Julian had become very close with and is actually still close with today. Julian has very fond memories of her childhood and has said that it was the people she was surrounded by that were the best kind of people. So just everyone around her were just amazing people. So when she became the age to attend school, she went to the Alexander von Humboldt School, which is a German Bavarian private school, which is located in, it is a very prestigious school and mainly catered to international students that were from fairly wealthy families. Here, she had friends, and like her childhood home life, she had very fond memories of her time here as well. According to her, she was a normal kid, she was happy, and she was healthy. Her parents had a dream, though. One they had held on to for a long time. One that would take their research and conservation passions, as well as their skills, to the next level. They dreamed of opening a conservation and research center right there in the Peruvian jungle. And like with everything else in their lives, they did it. In 1968, the couple was finally able to see their dreams through when they opened their facility, which they named Panguana. I believe that's how you say it. Here they plan to live deep in the Peruvian jungle for around 5 years while they studied the native flower and plant life along with the animals, which are called flora and fauna.
Flora and fauna are fauna.
Fauna. So flowers are flora.
Mm-hmm.
Animals are fauna.
Hmm. I didn't know that.
How neat is that? Like, I'm just going to go see the rainforest fauna over here.
So cool.
Okay, anyway. So, like, the problem was that Panguana was far. It took several days of traveling through rivers, trails, and the jungle in order to get there. The trip was long and it was dangerous. During their travel, they would have to sleep wrapped in wool blankets on riverbanks, and they had to use their combined instincts and skills in order to survive the trip there.
Damn.
So it's like way
right
the fuck in the jungle. No, thank you.
No, I'm good.
Yeah. Julie would later say that at the time of this journey, she was 14 years old, and she wasn't really psyched about the idea of living in the forest like that. She said she loved being out there and doing what she did and learning everything that she did, but her parents' idea of living in the jungle wasn't exactly what she wanted, which,
exactly.
Some people might. Tarzan. So she said, quote, "I was less than thrilled by the idea of living in the jungle. I imagine sitting all day in the gloom under tall trees whose dense canopy of leaves wouldn't let a single ray of sunlight in." So luckily, because of the closeness she had with her parents, coupled with her adventurous and adaptive nature, she was able to find that she loved living in the jungle. It wasn't easy, though. They lived in a house that was set on stilts, and it had half walls and a canopy rather than a roof. The home was very high up because it had to be up due to the flooding that happens within the jungle, as well as to be able to be protected from predators. Living this far into the jungle, Julian had to watch out for poisonous animals like spiders, snakes, and even frogs. Literally anytime she did anything.
That'd be stressful.
Right? Exactly. No, thank you. Right? No.
He said you learned to adapt.
No.
Well, yeah, he is right, though, because eventually it would just become a routine. Like, you wouldn't even... You know what I mean? Like, it would just become an everyday thing. Like, okay. You wouldn't think about it.
Hold that thought.
Shit, here we fucking go.
At any moment, even while sleeping, she was surrounded by animals. Right. They were constantly removing these creatures from their house.
If you're in my jungle, I'd be curious too.
But first, before they could remove them from their house, they had to make sure they weren't poisonous. So, like, you are surrounded by even poisonous animals while you're asleep.
Yeah, but it would become, you would be so used to it, though. You see what I'm saying?
But what if you roll over and you accidentally touch a poisonous dart frog?
You're done. Yeah, you're done.
That is so stressful.
But you would get to the point where, like, you wouldn't be scared about it. And you know what I mean?
Like, I'm good.
If you see a spider in your bathroom.
I'm good.
Yeah. You're used to it. That's now. Just like now. Like,
I know. I'm terrified of fucking spiders. Keep that shit the fuck over there. I'm good. No, thank you.
I don't know. I'm trying to help you out, but it's not
working. No. I'm terrified of spiders. Can't do them.
Can't do spiders.
You'll feel that way once I show you a picture. Just wait.
Oh, here we go. Okay. Shit.
Just wait.
God, she always ruins it with pictures. She always sends me the pictures.
Okay, so the biggest pests that they had in their house were fruit bats, which fruit bats aren't harmful.
I didn't think they were.
No, they're just big.
Right.
They're just bigger.
Yeah, they're just big. I don't do spiders or bats, okay?
I think bats are cute.
Nope. I'm good.
They're just like...
They're not little.
I don't do either one. No, thank you. Okay. I grew up in North Carolina hiking, being in the woods, surrounded by spiders. Right. I had no problem with spiders as a kid. I played with spiders as a fucking kid. Like, no problem. But then I was bit by a spider on my face. You remember me telling you about that?
Yeah.
I don't do spiders. Ever since then, I still don't know what kind of spider it was, but whatever kind of spider it was, I'm allergic to, and it was poisonous. And it almost killed me. No, thank you.
So you got PTSD.
I'm good. I don't fuck with spiders. I don't care how big it is. I don't care how little it is. You said spider energy. I don't mess with spiders. They like, just eight-legged freaks gives me the chills, okay?
Right.
Like, that's how terrified of spiders I am. And I know that movie's fake. I've watched it a million times. But even that movie, I'm just like, ooh, nope. Just the thought of spiders just makes me want to.
Can't do it.
Nope. Then with bats. I fucking hate bats. I've never told you this. Okay. When I was living with my mom, there in Chumla, when I was 17, I woke up in the middle of the night. I don't know what it was for, but I woke up in the middle of the night for something. And we lived in an apartment, me and her. All the lights were off, right? I walk out of my bedroom and I see something move. I'm like, what the fuck? You know, I turned the light on, but I didn't see anything, but I heard like a screeching sound. And I'm looking around, trying to figure out what this noise is. Can't find it. Don't know what it is. So I shut the light back off and it moves again. I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I'm starting to freak out at this point. Turn the light on, nothing. But the screeching noise is back. No idea what it is. I turned the light off. I turn around to go to my room and whatever it was flew at my face.
So you swear it's a bat.
It was a bat. It was a bat because I dropped down and I'm screaming. Mama can tell you this happened. I'm not even playing because I woke her and the guy that I was dating because Mike and I were not together dating at the time. Woke both of them up out of a dead sleep because I'm screaming. Okay. They will come running out to see what's freaking wrong. I don't know what it was at that point. It was just whatever it was flew at my face. Like it tried to fucking eat me, dude. Like. Well, we look over, there's a little bat on the fucking wall in the living room. A bat tried to eat my face.
So now you got PTSD from bats, too.
Yep. I don't do bats. I'm good. No, thank you. Like, I'm not scared of them. I just don't fuck with bats.
Right.
Because a bat tried to eat my face. I'm good.
I don't think it was trying to eat your face.
Yes, it was. You weren't there.
That is true.
You don't know.
Speak on it.
Justified.
It tried to eat my face. Scared the shit out of me. Like, I'm not gonna lie. Which, mind you, I was also half asleep. That did not help
the situation. Right.
At all. It was awful. Okay, anyway. Now that we've talked about how spiders and bats traumatized me.
Get back to the case.
Okay, so obviously, they had no electricity, no running water. They did that because they didn't want any modern devices or noises that would scare the animals.
Right.
Which I don't know if I could not have. Well, they're in the Amazon rainforest. They could bathe in the rainforest.
Yeah.
Yes. Never mind. They could bathe in the rainforest. So, anyway. So, Julian had prepared her entire life for this. And every day, not only were her skills being put to the test, but she was learning new ones as well. During this time, she and her parents had got even closer, and they taught her everything they had to in order for her to be able to survive on her own had something happen. But every day, making sure she could live out on her own.
Yeah.
Then, in 1970, that way of life for Julianne had come to an end. While this far in the jungle, Julianne couldn't attend a normal school, obviously. So, she's being homeschooled. But after a year and a half, the powers to be began to raise concerns that she wasn't getting a proper education. Because, you know, you get to decide my child has proper education.
Of course.
Yeah. So these powers told her parents that if Julianne didn't return to Lima to attend a regular school with a regular curriculum, they would not allow her to graduate.
Damn.
Yeah.
That's bullshit.
Even though she's learning valuable things, like she's learning shit that nobody else is.
She's doing science. She's doing history. She's probably doing math. Mm-hmm. You think about she's doing all the core classes that she would need and more. Survival. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you honestly think about it, she's doing everything. She's just not learning it how you would learn it in school. She's actually doing hands-on.
Yeah. And I think that's what the problem was, is she wasn't learning it
in the way they wanted to teach it.
Exactly. So understanding this and believing that Julianne had learned enough of what they could teach her at that point, they sent her back to Lima to live with family friends to attend school while her parents stayed there in
the rainforest.
Yes. Well, the whole thing is in the rainforest, but in their paying Yuna. Okay. So Julianne, like I said before, was adaptive, and she was able to fall right back into normal life and into school as if she had never left. Power to her, because I don't know if I could ever go from living a year and a half in the rainforest to be able to just go right back into normal everyday life. I don't know if I could do that. That's a lot. Two totally different
worlds. That's a different transition.
Oh, yeah. Two totally different worlds. So the following December of 1971, Julianne had crushed her schoolwork, and she had been able to earn all of her credits and grades in order to graduate, which she would do on December 3rd of 1971. So they're like, oh, well, she can't graduate. She's not learning. And yet here she is.
Crushed it.
On time. So she obviously couldn't wait for graduation or for the Fiesta de Promoción. I believe that's how you say it. I'm not sure, though. So this was a party that the school threw to celebrate the graduating class. So kind of like, you know, like here in America, we have prom and graduation parties. It was like that. Maria had joined Julianne in Lima that November to spend time with her, and the two had planned to fly back to Pacopa, where they would then celebrate Christmas together before Maria traveled back to Panguana to be with Julianne's dad. Originally, Maria was supposed to leave a few days prior, but Julianne had wanted her to stay for graduation, so she did. I mean, it's her only daughter, you know what I mean?
Right.
So Maria's first choice for their airline was Fawcett Airlines, but due to the holiday and only a day away, there were no available flights. The only remaining option was to fly with Lanza Airlines, with Lanza being the only airline besides Fawcett that flew to Pacopa and having tickets available. She had no choice but to book the flight.
Yeah, and to make sure it was still going.
There's the airline. It's fucking, I don't know why the fuck they were still operating, but they were. I had a long and bad history of crashes, faulty planes, and other mishaps. Hans was horrified once he learned that they would be flying with this airline. He insisted that they cancel their flights and fly with a different airline, even if it meant that they had to stay another day and fly back on Christmas Day instead. Hans did not want them anywhere near that airline, but Maria wanted to get home. She told Hans, not every plane is going to crash, and she kept their tickets for December 20th. So before we continue, I'm going to give you some background on Lanza Airlines, okay?
Okay.
This company, like I said before, had a horrific history that started in 1971 that spanned back 20 years. In April of 1966, only 3 years after its founding, their first crash happened. Lanza Flight 501 from Lima to Cusco crashed into treacherous mountain conditions only 10 minutes after takeoff, killing all 49 passengers on board. After the investigation, the crash was caused by pilot error. Then, in 1970, the airline would once again claim the lives of travelers. Lanza Flight 502, flying from Cusco to Lima, carrying 100 passengers, had a fire in its third engine, forcing the plane to turn around and land back in Cusco. but they would never make it. The engine became engulfed in flames. It descended quickly into the valley, then crashed into the mountainside above a village. After the plane crashed, its fuel caught fire. Everyone on board died except for the co-pilot, who was found in the cockpit badly burned. The crash and its fire also killed two farm workers on the ground.
Oh, wow.
Investigations into the crash found that it was caused by the failure of the flight crew to execute the correct engine out procedures and faulty maintenance.
Yeah, I have no time no more.
I know. New fear unlocked.
Right?
That's a wrap.
Following this investigation, Lanza was sanctioned with a 90-day suspension, and news of this airline's failure spread across the globe. The news of this faulty airline hit hard, and it spread as far as it did due to the fact that these deaths were international. Among the number of nationals that lost their lives, there were at least two Swiss, one Canadian, three German, and one Spain national, along with four Americans, which made this more significant because between the two flights, at least 53 Americans were now dead.
Oh, wow. Damn.
Yeah. So it was a huge deal.
Right.
After the second flight, or crash, I mean. So once the 90-day suspension was over, it was lifted, Lanza would have its third and final crash, cementing Lanza's horrific legacy. So having booked their tickets and basically telling Hans not to worry, Maria and Julian arrive at the airport to pure chaos. With all other flights booked, everyone is fighting to get the remaining seats on Lanza's flight. Like I said before, this was their last plane. This was it. Right. Lanza had no other airplanes. Julian said that she had looked out at the plane before boarding and said it looked like it was brand new. So she had no worries. She wasn't concerned.
Hell, it should look brand new. It's the only one they got.
What Julian, her mother, and all the other passengers did not know was that Lanza Flight 508, plane model L1, was specifically designed to fly in desert conditions, not in the rainforest. This plane was not built to withstand heavy turbulence, which is faced when flying above the rainforest mountains. And this wasn't the worst fact that no one knew. Are you ready for the worst part?
Let's do it. Let's go.
This plane was built from spare parts of other planes.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Nope. This was a junkyard plane.
No way.
Yep.
That's bogus.
That was like determined.
Yeah, like you just, you knew it was going to crash.
Yeah.
It was just a matter of time.
Yep.
That's bogus.
So Julian and Maria sat in row 19, the second to the last in the back of the plane. There were 92 passengers and crew members on board. So total, 92 people. This flight was only supposed to be an hour long. About 30 minutes into the flight, the flight attendants brought lunch to the passengers, and a short while later, came back around to collect the lunches just as the plane flew through the clouds into a stormy patch. The plane had just flown directly into a thunderstorm. Typically, pilots will not fly through a storm.
Right.
They avoid it, even if that means that they have to divert or land the plane and add flight time. They will not fly through a storm.
Right.
Because it is dangerous. You're in a giant metal can. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, right. You're just asking for something.
Lightning or something.
Yeah. Right. A plane is literally a homing beacon for lightning. So why the fuck this pilot flew through a storm? I don't have a fucking clue.
You're dumb, my guy.
Yeah. So Julian said all of a sudden, she felt a jolt of severe turbulence. Which turbulence, while in the air, is pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not that bad.
Right.
At all. The worst part of the turbulence is taking off and landing.
I've flown one time, but I was like 9 or 10. So, yeah.
I've flown a lot. It's not.
Yeah, you've flown.
It's not that bad.
The rest is supposed to be smooth.
Yeah, for the most part, it typically is.
Yeah.
You might have a little bit, you know, bumpy here or there. That's it. She felt a sudden jolt of severe turbulence.
No, thank you.
So bad. Luggage and personal items began to fall out of the overhead bins. And of course, panic ensued. She said her mother was clearly anxious as this began to happen. And then she remembered seeing a flash of white light as lightning struck the right wing of the plane. I want to note, because it's a scary thought, obviously, Lightning strikes, causing your plane to crash, does not happen as often as you think. Huh. Okay. There are parts built into planes now which diverts the energy. So, you know those, you know, like on the tail, as like those weird looking like square things. Mm-hmm. They look like they go back and forth. And those are on the wings as well. Those have like mesh stuff in them that diverts the energy that hits the plane off of it.
Right.
Planes get struck by lightning all the time.
Right.
It's normal. You're in the fucking air. But those are there to divert the energy so it does not cause any type of electrical malfunctions or anything like that. So, typically, planes get hit at least once or twice a year. Every plane. Which is why pilots are trained to avoid storms. If they can. So, these diversion systems I just told you about, those began to be put in planes around 1966. So, they were in planes the time this crash happened.
That's wild.
But because it's a junkyard plane, it does not have those.
That's what I was going to say. It doesn't have it.
Okay. So the odds of a plane going down directly due to a lightning strike, due to nothing else, are really low. Experts estimate that those odds are 1 billion to 1.
Oh, wow.
So it's a very, very small chance that only lightning is going to cause your plane to go down.
It's a teeny tiny chance.
Yeah. The last flight to crash due solely to lightning happened in 1967. And after investigation, that was the only reason it went down. Typically, if a plane goes down after being hit by lightning, there's another reason. Because again, 1 billion to 1 chance. It's very, very small. So sometimes planes will land due to a lightning strike, but not necessarily crash. And that's because, you know, it damaged the wing or, you know, something like that. Everything is so advanced now and the safety checks are so thorough that if a plane can't survive being struck by lightning, it's not going to go up. It's going to be decommissioned. Plane can't fly anymore. So now that that is
explained.
Yes. Make you feel a little bit better about it.
No.
Maybe. So when the lightning struck Julian's plane, Flight 508, it hit the right wing, like I said. It appeared that the plane had nothing to divert the energy because it hit the plane as if it would have struck any normal object. Julian said, quote, "With a jolt, the tip of the plane fell steeply downward. I could see the whole aisle to the cockpit, which was below me." So the plane went nose down. So people are screaming in panic. Girl cries for help. The roar of the plummeting turbines, which she says she would hear over and over again in her dreams. It just engulfed her. That's all she could hear.
That would be scary to hear all those people screaming and like you don't know what's going to happen. Well, obviously, you know what's going to happen. But you know what I'm saying? Like, you know what's going to happen, but you don't want to believe what's going to happen. And then all these people screaming and there's like not shit you can fucking do about it.
It's like a bad fucking dream.
Yeah.
And then add in the turbines, the big ass plane engine.
Yeah. No, I'm good.
Yeah.
Yeah. Screw that shit.
That's like some movie type.
Yeah. Like you'd see on a movie. You'd see it on a movie, not think that it would really happen to you. Like you would really be living it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so just imagine. Your whole life is flashing before your eyes. You know how they say that saying? Like, your life flashes before your eyes. That's exactly what it would feel like.
That's some scary shit.
Oh, yeah.
Then you're there with your mom, trying to protect your mom while also trying to protect other people.
Yeah, and then probably replaying what your dad or your husband told
you. Right, exactly.
Don't take that. Redo your ticket.
And she's like, not every plane is going to crash.
Yeah. And then so you're reliving that in your...
Yeah.
The last thing she remembers hearing was her mother's voice, which was as clear as glass above all the other noise. Her mother's voice was quiet and calm. Maria said, "Now it's all over."
They gave me goosebumps.
Right after that, the plane took a sharp nosedive, which meant it went straight down.
Right.
Nose first. The next thing Julian remembers is the roar of the turbines opening her eyes and being outside. Hey, hush! Julian is still strapped in her seat, and she is now free falling from the sky.
No. I would have had a heart attack. No. I'm good.
The plane has essentially blown apart from around, and it all happened as soon as the lightning struck it. Now, her row of seats is spiraling towards the ground, all while Julian goes in and out of consciousness. So, to paint a picture, you know those little helicopter seats like that?
Yeah.
They fall up, you throw them up, and they spin like this?
Yeah.
That is how her seat is falling towards the ground.
No.
I would never want to play ever again.
Yep.
No, I'm good.
I would walk if I had to fly on the plane.
She's like this towards the ground, and it's just spinning.
And imagine how fast it's going.
Well, she believes that this was this is what caused her survival, was because of how the seats fell. So after the plane fell apart around her, rather than the road just plummet, it flipped sideways or upside down with the heavy side down, which so the side that she's sitting in. The row of seats then began to spiral, which caused wind resistance, which slowed the rate at which she fell.
Okay. I see what you're saying now.
It's crazy to think that. So eventually, she reaches the ground. Julian has just crashed into the middle of the Amazon rainforest after free falling from the sky. Are you ready?
Yeah.
For 10,000 feet.
There's no way in hell I would have had a fucking heart attack. I'm terrified of heights. There's no way I would have made it.
She just survived falling from a plane, torn apart by lightning. She fell through a thunderstorm.
Oh, I forgot about the thunderstorm.
Yeah.
Imagine how traumatic.
Plummeted 10,000 feet from the sky and crashed into the canopy of the rainforest.
Dude, that's got PTSD written all over it. Like, you just unlocked,
right?
Like, a handful.
It's a thousand of new fears. There's more to come.
Her mom died and you survived. On the same.
Well, did her mom die?
If her mom did die.
We haven't heard yet. We haven't heard that in story.
But I'm saying, if her mom died, that is extra.
So the voice that y'all are hearing right now is my daughter's voice. And my grandbaby cooing, if y'all
while
hear
he's
that.
Sleeping.
While he's sleeping.
Imagine they don't, and they think you're going crazy.
Yeah.
Right, you're just talking to yourself.
If Carrie doesn't edit it out.
Okay, so now Julian has to survive the vastly treacherous world that is the Amazon rainforest. And she has to do it alone.
But she has been trained to do it, though, too.
Yes.
But with her parents.
So, once Julian hit the ground, everything around her went black. After an unknown amount of time, Julian said that she began to have connected dreams. She said that she was running through a tight, dark space, trying not to touch anything. She said it was loud, like a roaring, humming sound of an engine surrounding her. Before she knew it, she was then shot into a different dream where she was obsessively needing to wash herself because she was covered in mud and some kind of like sticky stuff. In this dream, she said that she kept thinking, all you have to do is get up. And then she woke up. She was no longer attached to her row of seats. At some point in her fall, she had become unbuckled from her seat and was now instead huddled underneath them. She was soaking wet because it was raining. It's raining.
Right.
She was covered in dirt, mud, and blood. Considering what she had just faced, her injuries were minor because she was lucky to not have been harmed far worse. And she was lucky just to be alive, to be honest with you.
Right.
Like, I would have had a fucking aneurysm and would have died before I ever hit the ground.
Most definitely.
So Julian had a severe concussion, which she sustained after getting a cut above her left eye, which had been swollen shut. Her left eye was swollen shut, so she'd only see out of one eye now. Her clavicle, which is your collarbone, was broken. She had a very deep cut on her arm and an open gash on her leg. She would later find out that she had actually ruptured a ligament in her knee.
Oh.
So, serious injuries, but considering what she just faced, those are minor. So, her body is coursing full of shock and adrenaline, so she felt no pain, obviously. And it's a good thing, because she would have been in severe fucking pain. She said her first thoughts were that, she said, quote, a boundless feeling of abandonment. There was no one else around her, no plane, no bodies, no other living person. Julian was in the middle of the Amazon rainforest alone. And to make it worse, she had lost her glasses, which she needed to see.
Shit.
Yeah. So she has no glasses. She can't see because she has bad vision already. And one of her eyes is swollen shut.
Swollen shut.
Yep. Julian eventually crawled out from underneath the row of seats and tried to stand up.
Okay.
So step back, taking it for a minute. She's a 17-year-old girl.
Right.
Who just fell 10,000 feet. after her plane blew up around her. She has a concussion, a gash in her leg, a wound in her arm, a broken collarbone, a ruptured ligament in her knee, and then she just stands up like there's nothing wrong with her.
And a severe concussion.
Yeah. She just stands up. What she does, she blacks out. But just the fact that she was able to stand up is astonishing to me. So now, flight 508 was set to land at 4:30 p.m. that day. When it didn't show up with no communication from anyone, everyone began to panic. And it being Lanza Airlines, they believed the worst. Family and other loved ones were trying to find out what was going on from Lanza officials, but they were only given contradictory or half statements.
Well, of course.
Yeah. Because, you know, we can't fucking tell you any fucking thing. I don't think they knew what was going on, to be honest with you. So a search operation had begun, despite the lack of information given to those waiting for the flight to come in. This search was and still is the largest search party held in the history of Peru. Even with this fact, the search party was much smaller because, remember, it's Christmas and most officials were gone for the holiday. So even though that most of them were gone, it's still the largest search party ever. How crazy is that?
That is crazy.
So, like I said, there was no communication with the plane and the canopy of the rainforest hid the crash site. So the helicopters and rescue planes that were sent out above the forest couldn't see the site. But Julian could see and hear them above her. But being on the ground and under the canopy, she was left helpless with no way to tell them that she was there. And they would never find her. Julian again loses consciousness and she remains blacked out for the rest of that day. She wakes up the next morning, which is Christmas Day. She is unable to stand without passing out. No matter how slow she tries to stand, she passes out every time. Finally, after countless times of trying, she is able to get up onto her knees. And after a long time and many struggles, she's able to stand. This was when she realized that her collarbone was broke. She said, quote, the two ends had pushed on top of each other. So the middle of her collarbone, where it curves right here into the U-shape, had broken and overlapped. I don't even want to imagine how painful that was. Because, like, most people, you break your collarbone, it's usually, like, out right here. She broke it right in the middle, like, underneath your throat, and it overlapped. Oh, my God. So this was the only reason that she knew that it was broken, because it didn't hurt, and it didn't break through the skin. If she wouldn't have felt it and felt that it was no longer together, she would have never had any idea that it was broken.
That's insane.
Yeah. Okay. So she may not have felt the pain, but it had to be fucking uncomfortable. Like, it had to be. Because I feel like it would make your arms, like scrunch in. I mean, I could be wrong, but I feel like that. And she dealt with that for 11 days.
Shit.
Yeah. Which, she says she was shocked that she didn't feel any pain. That's a queer shock, because it should have been fucking painful. So, anyway. Once she stood and she assessed her surroundings and she confronted the fact that her mother, who had been sitting right next to her on the plane, was nowhere to be found. Okay, she said that the loneliness of having to do this alone was the worst part of all of it. Not the fact that she stranded in the woods or just fell out of a plane. It's having to do it alone. That's the worst part for her. I feel like all of it is the worst part.
That's what I would say.
So Julian said that she made it her mission to find her mother, even if she was dead. She had to find. This was when all those years of living in the jungle and everything her parents taught her kicked in, and it finally became helpful. She had lived here. She knew the jungle, and she knew how to survive it. Even though she had never been in this exact situation, she was ready to face it. In her book, which I'm going to put in the description, she said that she told herself one thing, quote, with calm and methodical thinking, you could master almost any situation in which you end up in nature, which I love that.
I like that
so much. Like, if you can just calm yourself, you can think about it methodically and you can face it and you can get through it. But you have to be able to calm yourself to do it. I love that so much. So she said first she had to find her mother. But before she could do that, she had to find fresh water because humans can only survive 3 days without water. And at this point, she was beginning to become dehydrated because this is like day two at this point. So to do this, she started licking the leaves that she had found because it had rained and the water began to pool on the leaves.
I know.
She had to find a bigger water source, but this was all she had and it was going to have to do for now. So the lack of water or people or even bodies wasn't the only thing that she had noticed. There was little evidence of the plane crash anywhere around her.
Wow.
Yeah, like there were no plane parts, which is weird. She did, though, by luck, find a bag of candy and fruitcake. But unfortunately, the fruitcake had been stuck in the mud and it, like, soaked up for the rain, so it wasn't any good. She spent hours searching the little bit of the crash site that was around her, looking for food or water or anything that would help her survive. But there really wasn't anything there. It was during these hours that she kept hearing the planes and the helicopters above her. And with no way to signal them, she knew she had to make her way through the jungle and find people. And she's like, they're not going to find me. I have to find them.
Right.
Like, she knew from the beginning. So as she realizes this, she's also realizing that she can hear dripping and then realizes that it's running water. She follows the sound to where she finds a stream. And she follows this stream downstream. And she did it for hours. She climbed over trees and boulders. She bushwhacked her way along the stream until night fell. Obviously exhausted. So she found a place next to the stream where she slipped. Okay. So remember, she fell 10,000 feet out of the sky, crashed into the rainforest. Her collarbone is overlapping itself. She has multiple lacerations. One of her eyes is swollen shut. She can't see without her glasses. Now she's climbing over trees and cutting her way through thick forestry downstream. I would have given up.
Yeah, I would have been done.
Like, no. I'm done. I'll just lay here and die.
Yeah.
Just, I'll be food for the animals. I'm done. So by this time, the news of the crash has reached Hans, who had no idea that his wife and daughter had gone. He believed that they had heeded his warning and decided to catch another flight. The following day, his beliefs were crushed when he saw a news report that listed all the passengers and the names of his wife and daughter were on. He's obviously freaking out. Okay. Then put yourself in Julian's shoes. Knowing that her dad didn't want them to take that flight, not knowing where her mom was or what happened to her, that her mom just wanted to get home to Han, both were just filled with all the fucking things, you know? It's just horrible for everybody, all the way around. So now it's December 26th, so day three. Julian wakes up and continues following the stream, which was not straight. It was like windy, over things, under things, the whole way. Okay, so this made her track down it way worse and way more difficult. And even longer, if you added the obstacles, you would expect, like, you know, trees, boulders, all that. You either have to go over it, under it, around it. Took her way longer than you would think to walk
right
straight. You know what I mean? But she took all of them, and she faced every one of them. She recalled at one point on the 26th that she had seen a Goliath bird eater spider. This is a giant tarantula that eats fucking birds.
Oh, shit.
Girl.
I'm not scared of spiders, but damn.
Oh, my God. I'm going to show you a picture because I got a fucking picture.
Of course you do.
Oh, my God. Like this is going to unlock a new fear for you. Okay?
Like, you ain't unlocked enough.
Just wait. This thing is terrifying. There's no fucking way.
Oh, my God. It's bigger than his hand. Do you see it? He's like, yeah, no, I'm good. Wow.
No fucking thank you.
That thing is freaking huge, dude.
There is no way. I would die of a heart attack just from seeing this thing in person.
Oh, yeah. I'm going to figure out a way to go.
She can't run.
I'm going to scooch on the ground or something.
I'm going to have a heart attack. That's it. I'm done. Flatline.
You didn't have a heart attack from falling 10,000 feet, but you're going to have a heart attack from that?
Yes.
Spider. Oh.
It is the largest spider by mass and length.
Yeah, that thing's huge.
Its legs can span up to 12 inches. One leg is a foot long.
Yeah, I'm good.
Mm-hmm. Its body length can go up to 5.1 inches, and it can weigh up to 6.2 ounces. Their fangs are anywhere from 2 to 4 centimeters long, depending on its age. No.
No, I'm good. I'm good, my guy.
And they do have venom. Now, the venom is more like being stung by a wasp. But either way, no fucking thank you. Okay? You get bit by that thing, people are going to think you got bit by a damn vampire or some shit. No. I would have an aneurysm, I would have an heart attack, and then I would die.
You're going to die from the aneurysm. You ain't even going to have time to have a heart attack.
You can have an aneurysm and live.
Very rarely.
But it happens. Okay, I'm going to have both.
No, thank you.
Julian said that this thing alone would have killed her if she had come too close to it.
Yeah.
So, she's having to go through this long-ass walk, punch out for these giant-ass spiders, okay, bigger than a grown man's hand, other insects, and predators, because it's the Amazon rainforest. They got jaguars, poisonous dart frogs, electric eels, piranhas, anacondas, and black caiman.
Shit, the piranhas alone.
Which black caimans are a species of an alligator.
I was wondering about that.
Along with the other countless deadly animals. No fucking thank you.
And her injuries on top of that.
Yes. Oh my God. Bitch, I'm dead. I'm dead. Don't send a search party. I'm dead. I'm gone. Ain't no fucking way. Like, when I say she is a badass, she is a badass.
She is for real. She's the new G.I. Jane.
Right, exactly. Okay, so throughout her entire journey, she can hear the planes above her, searching for Flight 508. After hours and hours of following the stream downward, it opens up into a big river, which Julian goes into. Okay, not around. She wades into the river thinking, okay, I'm going to float down river with the piranhas, the caiman, and the damn electric eel. Can't. But she's like, I'm just, you know, current's going to take me down. Take her to people. I get the logic. I get the thinking.
Right.
But the animals in the water. Like.
That you can't see.
Exactly.
I'm okay if I can see them. It's the ones that I can't see that freak me out.
It's like a, I don't know. The animals on land is dangerous. The Amazon land is very dangerous. But the water has to be more dangerous because in the water, like I said, they have anacondas, caimans, piranhas. They also have bull sharks.
I didn't know that.
Bull sharks can live in both saltwater and freshwater. They're one of the most dangerous sharks.
Right.
They're very aggressive. And they will bite you just to bite. Yep. So she had found one of her slippers. And so she puts it on her foot. And as she's wading through the water, she's like rubbing that foot along the ground so that like to kick anything that she can't see. Because, you know, like, caiman, they'll dig themselves into the sand. By doing that, it stirs them up, which I don't know if you want to do that.
Though. So I was going to say, do you want to stir that up? I don't know. She knows more than we do.
Right? Like, I don't know. Would it come up and just try to bite you? Or would it swim away because you've just fucking kicked it in its face? I'm not sure.
Right.
But I don't know if I want to do that. Then she had also found a walking stick that she poked around the water in front of her. I don't know if I would want to do that either, but that's just me. She knows a whole lot more about this stuff than we do because I don't have a clue. So then while doing this, she's slowly eating the candy that she had found to keep up her energy. So she walked through the river for hours like this. And then she finally saw a small piece of the plane wreckage. Well, it's not really small. It's one of the large turbines sitting in the middle of the river. So it's not a small piece, but just a chunk of it. She says she stood there staring at it, amazed at what she was seeing. She said, quote, then I got happy because it meant that I was likely going in the right direction to find more pieces of the plane and possibly more people. She was convinced that she was not the only survivor. She says she kept telling herself, quote, there's no way that only I survived this plane crash. Julian said years later that she would return to this memory. She said she would return to it over and over and think about it all the time, that it amazed her how she had this detachment from discovering proof of the plane that had exploded from around her. She said, quote, I was looking at a piece of the plane that I had just been sitting on 2 days earlier. I'm sitting there going, wow, that's interesting. That means there's other people over there, I bet. Now, this is when they began to send in ground searches to go through the jungle on foot searching for the site, but it was not very well organized. Like, at all.
I bet.
They were sending people in all different directions. Like, they were just like, just go. It was not, like, cut into a grid. Or they were just, here you go. Be free.
Watch for the spiders and the piranhas.
Yeah. Into the wild you go. Okay, so, you know, they're getting false leads. They're getting shitty tips to where people are saying that the plane went down. Because of all this, the government issued a media blackout in order for their guys to be able to do what they had to do without getting these, you know, these shitty ass people calling in with this fake report. So they had the fake reports, false reports being played out in the media on the news, along with these people calling, oh, I saw the plane go down here. So the downside, though, was that the families of the people on the plane were also being kept in the dark. They weren't being told shit. Day four. Where we're at. Day four. So, day four. It brought a horrible memory and a horrific discovery for Julianne. She had said on day four, she had already been walking for a few hours when she heard, quote, the flapping of large wings. Unmistakable, louder, and lasting longer than that of other birds. She knew just from hearing this sound what it was. It was the king vulture. The name alone. No fucking thank you.
Right. Sounds like a fucking dinosaur.
This bird has a wingspan of 6 feet.
No, I'm good. No, I'm terrified of birds because they will peck my head.
This one will eat you.
Yeah.
Its wingspan is as tall as Mike.
Yeah, no, I'm good.
That's a big ass bird. There's a lot that she remembered from her mom, from her mother's lessons about the king vulture. But the most significant was that the large presence of them only meant one thing, that there was a large amount of carrion close by. Carrion refers to meat that is dead and rotting.
So like a buzzard, just bigger.
Yeah, it's just like,
yeah, massive.
Way bigger, but yes. So Julianne left the river and walked into the jungle until she reached a row of 3 seats from the flight. The row was upside down, lodged 3 feet deep into the ground, and all three passengers were strapped to their seats, lodged headfirst into the ground.
Oh, God.
Julianne fought against every instinct in her to run away because it's horrific. First, you find these big-ass vultures. Then there's a seat from a plane with three people in it upside down. So instead of running, she went closer because even though she knew none of them were her mom, she had to make sure. In the seat, it was clearly two men and a woman. Using a stick, she removed the woman's shoe and saw that her toenails were painted, which told her it was not her mom because Maria never painted her toenails. While doing this, the king vulture reached the area, perched up on a tree, basically waiting for her to leave. Just sitting up there, just like, bitch, go the fuck on somewhere.
That's so awful. I can eat.
It's awful to say. So she searched the area for anything that she could find useful. And there wasn't really anything, so she went back to the river. By the time night began to fall, she had no food. And because the crash had happened during the rainy season for the Amazon, there were no fruit on or near the floor that she could eat. Where fruit was there, she couldn't reach because it was too high in the trees. She drank from the river to keep somewhat hydrated. I mean, it's gross water, but better than nothing, I guess. So she's now exhausted and extremely hungry. She comes across a barrier of driftwood and tangled weeds at this point, which are possible to climb. So she has to leave the river again, which was difficult and dangerous. So now she has to get through the very dense and untraveled jungle for hours before she can finally get around it and back into the river. It's just too much going on. Like, there's just no way. So when she's back into the river for the first time, she's able to see an opening in the canopy above. And here she can see the plane above her, thinking that since she can see it, maybe it can see her. So she began to wave her arms. She was screaming, throwing things, doing everything she could to get their attention. But it hovers and it leaves. It didn't see or hear her. At this point, the days are just kind of starting to blend together. So for Julianne, the next few days are just like, they're just meshed up. And she recalls to the best she can onto what is now, she believes, days 5 and 6. Julianne said that it was at this point that she finally took in the realization of her situation. And she began to think about not only what happened, but also how vast and massive the jungle was. She said at this point, she began to lose hope and she couldn't let it consume her. That if she had really fallen into the thinking of what was and was not around her, she would have lost herself and she wouldn't have been able to go forward. Okay, so I'm going to explain just how vast this rainforest is. Okay, we all know the rainforest is massive, but I'm going to explain how massive it is and just how much she's up against. You know what I'm saying? Trying to get my words to come out right. So the Amazon rainforest is the world's largest rainforest. It spans across 9 countries in South America.
Holy shit.
It carries the largest amount of fresh water on Earth, 4,000 miles of it, which is about 20% of Earth's fresh liquid. The Amazon rainforest is home to 1/5 of the world's land species, some being found nowhere else but the Amazon. There's many indigenous tribes within the Amazon, many of them being uncontacted and isolated from the outside world. The Amazon rainforest spans over 2,700,000 square miles, with at least 1,620,000 square miles being covered with a vast canopy of trees.
That's insane.
The river itself is anywhere from 6.8 miles wide in the dry season to 24.8 miles wide in the wet season. And the depth can range anywhere from 66 feet in the dry season to 330 feet deep during the rainy season. Yeah. She's walking through all that.
That's what I was going to say.
And it's the rainy season, too.
Right.
Yeah. And although about 300 million people live on the land that is the Amazon rainforest, there are no documented humans living under the canopy itself. And that's where Julian is. So the odds of Julian simply running into another person is slim to none. It's really less than that, to be honest. It's nearly impossible that she's going to run into another person.
Yeah.
Knowing this and coming to this realization, most people would have given up. But not Julian. She continued downstream. She knew that if she just floated and let the current take her, she would conserve her energy and it would keep her safer from animals and things on land as well. So she just floated. She would be safe from the animals inside the water as well as from the animals on land. Which I don't know if I'd ever thought of that. I'd be like, I don't want to be on land or in the water. Put my ass in a tree, okay? No. Well, hell, you can't be in a tree either.
No.
I'm just done. No, thank you. Okay. So she wasn't just facing danger from animals. From the animals either. During the day, the temperatures under the canopy would be anywhere between 85 to 95 degrees and humid. Then the nights got cold once the sun went down. And then she's wet on top of it.
Right.
So during the day, she's being beaten by the heat. And the break, it's because sometimes throughout the canopy, there's like little tiny breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So then she's being beaten to death by the sun. Then at night, she's wet and freezing. All while also being eaten by insects. No, thank you. So now day 7, which up till now, her concussion has kind of kept her brain in like a fog kind of state, just like survival mode. Now at day 7, she's really thinking about her mom and the reality of the situations really started to set in. So some of her thoughts were typical because she's 17. So she's like, you know, what she missed out on at that moment? What are her friends doing? All that. Then other times she's wishing she could eat her favorite junk food. You know, things like, what's the meaning of this? What is the purpose of this? Why me? Those times she kind of went back. She didn't know how or why. But when thinking these things, she realized that her survival meant something, even if she didn't know what it was. She believed in that moment that this wasn't by accident. She was meant to be doing what she was doing. She didn't like it. Jesus Christ. She didn't like it. But she was also, I didn't just survive 7 days in the Amazon rainforest alone to just die now. So she's like, at this point, I've gotten this far. I have to keep going. I can't give up now. She's like, I'm meant to be here. It's all for a reason. And it was that moment that she decided that she was going to get out of there. She was going to live a meaningful life, and she was going to contribute to the world. She still believed, though, that there had to be more survivors. There was no way that she was the only one who survived through the crash. Which, what are the odds of that? So while trying to find her way out, she was still looking for other people. Now, at a week after the crash, she began to notice that her cuts started to look pretty bad. And now they're beginning to hurt. The cut on her calf had become irritated and swollen. Then she's in the dirty river water. So it's just making it worse. Like all the infection brewing in there. Then the cut on her arm not only hurts, but it also now began to feel hot. Yeah. So you know that she's infected. But it's on the back of her arm. So she can't really see it. But if she strained hard enough, she could kind of see it. So she finally managed to, like, at least get a decent look at it. And it was much worse than she thought. Are you ready to be grossed out?
You're not showing me a picture, are you?
No, I'm not showing you a picture. I'm going to describe it. Okay. Are you ready to be grossed out?
Yep.
Maggots have begun to burrow into the wound.
And there's my mom.
And bot flies had laid eggs inside the wound, most likely while she was asleep.
Those things creep me the fuck out.
The whole thing just did.
Oh. She knew she had to do something because if she allowed the maggots to continue to burrow their way into her arm would have to be amputated. She tried to pull them out herself by molding a piece of metal into a pair of tweezers, but she couldn't get them. So she gave up and continued downward. Yeah. So like I said, Julian knew the jungle well. She grew up in it. She knew how, you know, all the animals were. She knew the jungle was more afraid of her than she was of it. I don't know about that. I'm pretty worried about the jungle at this point. Like,
yeah.
So she also knew that animals kept their distance, like we said before. As she makes her way farther downriver, she begins to see animals that she would normally not see. Ones that would normally stay hidden are making themselves aware that they are there, seeming to watch and follow her as if they're curious. This told her these animals had probably rarely or possibly never seen a human being before. Their lack of fear was evident of that. And this crushed her spirit and hope in getting out of there, because now she knew that she was completely cut off and isolated from everyone else, because these animals don't fear humans. So it's clear they're not aware that there should be a fear there. So she's realizing how cut off she is from the outside. I could not, oh my God, like to know that it is literally you and these giant ass animals. No fucking way. So days 8 and 9, the sun really unleashed its hell on her. Day 8, she woke up with a searing pain on her back and shoulders. She realized she now had a second degree burns on both, and that the burns had actually broken open and began to bleed. There was nothing she could do about it. So while in massive pain and bleeding, she continues on. Day 8 is also the day that she began to hallucinate as well. She kept being sure that she was seeing houses in the distance. She also kept hearing chickens, but it was just jungle birds around her making noises. This would break any other person, but for Julian, it pushed her even harder. While hearing and seeing these false things, her foot got stuck in the sandbank, which made her trip and fall. At this point, Julian had fallen 10,000 feet out of the sky through a thunderstorm. Okay. She had 2 major wounds, a concussion, maggots and bot fly larvae are in her arm. She has second degree burns on her back and shoulders, a ruptured knee ligament. She has went 8 days with no food and very little water. She is no doubt fighting several infections. And now she hits the ground. All she wants to do is sleep.
Oh, great.
Her body is urging her to sleep, so she closes her eyes and rests on the jungle floor. Julian said she opens her eyes after being woken by the birds above her chirping, but it wasn't a bird at all. As she came to, she realized she knew that sound. It was the sound of a baby caiman, and then she saw its mother. The two approached her in a very aggressive and threatening way. She said if she had jumped up the way her body had urged her to, the way any of us would have, because I had jumped up right up. Nope, the fuck right out of there. She said that they would have attacked her and they would have gotten to her in an instant. If she would have done what all of us would have done, there was no chance she would have survived them. The only chance she had was to slide away from them. So she slid very slowly on the ground until she was back into the river and let the current carry her away. There is no fucking way I would have been able to calmly do that.
Yeah.
Like this, that's why I said this shit is straight out of a movie. Like,
she's smart as fuck, though.
She is smart.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have thought about that. I would have instantly jumped up and ran away.
I would have been too scared. Shit.
Yeah. No way.
It's just,
I can't. So this cemented what she believed before. There were no other humans anywhere around her. Because she said there was a large number of caiman where she now found herself, which told her no other humans were there other than her. Her 9th day in the jungle is beyond exhausted. Her hunger was something she could no longer ignore. It was the only thing that she could think about at this point. This day, she tried for hours to catch poison dart frogs in order to eat something. Like, all of her energy was spent in trying to catch these fucking frogs. But in the end, she didn't catch anything, so she went to sleep. The 10th day, She spent most of it doing the same thing. She let the river carry her further downstream. And at this point, the river is becoming less and less open and more expansive. So now there's dams and driftwood that she has to climb over and avoid. She has no energy left in her. And as the day goes on, the sun begins to set. Julian saw what she thought was a gravel bank on the shoreline. She makes her way to the shore, climbs up onto the bank, and is just about to close her eyes to sleep when she sees something. In her head, she believes it's another mirage. She closes her eyes and looks again. She blinked and blinked, but every time, it was still there. She goes over and touches it, and it was real. Sitting right in front of her, tied to the bank, is a boat. It was a boat that looked new, as if it was in working order, which told her that someone who ran this boat was nearby. This find gave her newfound energy, energy that she didn't even know was left in her at this point. She explored the area with her newfound hope. She finds a footpath that was not natural. She followed the footpaths, which led her to a tambo, which is like a small shack that's made of, it's made by hand where people just kind of store supplies for like boats and fishing and shit. This was a major find because it told Julian that someone had been there before and there was gasoline, which would help her with her maggot-infested wound. She took the gas that she found, gritted her teeth, and poured the gasoline onto her wound. This would have been unimaginably painful. Okay, so she takes the gas she found, gritted her teeth, and poured gasoline onto her wound. This would have unimaginable amount of pain. Okay, but it is brilliant. It's something else that she had learned from her parents. She knew that this would do something internally to not only heal the wound, but it would help force the maggots. First, they would try to dig deeper. But once they realized that they couldn't get away from the gas, they would begin to find their way out. And it worked. They began to emerge looking for a way out and away from the gas. Julian was able to pull over 30 maggots from her arm.
That's fucking disgusting.
I mean, he's not wrong. It's gross, but he's not wrong.
Right, but still.
So she would later find out that there were far more in her arm than the 30 that she herself had removed.
Oh, you didn't say anything. I just lost my appetite.
No, seriously.
So now she's trying to figure out a plan. Up till now, she hadn't seen any other person, but the evidence around her said that someone was there within the recent past. She thought about taking the boat downstream, but then she realized how tired she was. So she decided she would just lay down for a little while and think about what to do next. As she's thinking things over, she came to the conclusion that taking the boat wasn't the best option. Because, yeah, it would help her, but it could potentially leave someone else stranded in the Amazon rainforest, and she couldn't do that. She wrote later, quote, "I cannot possibly save my own life and jeopardize another." So she took a tarp from the shack, she laid on the banks of the shore, and went to sleep. Now day 11 hits. She woke up, and still she saw no one around her. Then suddenly, she was hit with a depressing thought, one that hit her like a ton of bricks. The tambos were often used by hunters or lumberjacks while in the jungle. But then they would be left and abandoned for months, sometimes even forever. This was when she made the decision to continue floating downriver, hoping that she would come across a village or something that showed people were near. So as she's about to get back into the river, it began to rain. Her lack of food and water, her exhaustion, and the fact that her body is fighting off numerous infections, it seemed impossible for her to even move. She didn't have much strength left in her. So since it was raining, she decided to stay inside the shack until the rain passed. That afternoon, the rain finally stopped. And since no one had yet to show up at the tambo, she decided it was time for her to move on. But her body wouldn't stand up. She decided to stay and rest for another day before moving on. She's at a bad place at this point. She hasn't ate in over 6 days. She's only been able to drink dirty river water. She's been bitten all over by numerous insects. She's exhausted because when she tries to sleep, these bugs just zoom, you know, buzz around all over her head. So she can't sleep well. She's wet. She's cold. She has sunburn, all kinds of fucking injuries. Now her brain's messing with her. She's thinking that other people did live, but they stayed where they were. And because of that, they were saved. Her mind is telling her that she was the only one left because she left the crash site. And now she was stuck in the jungle forever because of her decision to leave that site. So now her head's just fucking with her. So she lay there in the shack for most of the 11th day, trying to catch anything that she could eat. There were frogs all around her, but she couldn't catch any of them. Her lack of food really began to shut her body down. But as twilight began to seep in and another day in the jungle starts to pass, she hears it. Voices in the distance. She sits right up, and as soon as she does, her mind tells her that she's hearing things. It's another auditory hallucination. But she keeps hearing those voices, and they sound as though they're getting closer and closer. Then suddenly, three men emerge from the jungle. The men jumped back in shock when they saw her inside the shack, which...
Well, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't go to your shack expecting to see a person sitting inside of it. These men had heard about the plane crash, and looking at her, they were like, holy shit. It was hard for Jolene to realize that she had been saved. But quickly, she regained her composure and said to the men in Spanish, quote, I'm a girl who was in the Lanta crash. My name is Julian. These three men were forest workers, and they had quickly brought Jolene to safety. They took her to their camp, gave her food, clean water, dry clothes, helped her tend to her wounds the best that they could, obviously, including removing more maggots from her arm. They praised her for staying at their shack rather than moving on. They told her that if she had moved on, she would have never been found, because the rainforest, as you went further out from where they were, got more and more uninhabited. You just go deeper and deeper into the jungle. And they told her, based on what they saw of her, she wouldn't have made it much farther. They told her that her body would have given out by the next day.
Wow, that's wild.
These three men weren't set to return to the shack that day either. They had decided to go back to make sure that the boat was still tied up after the rainstorm. If it hadn't been for that rainstorm, they wouldn't have returned. She right away asked them about other survivors. This was when Julian learned they had yet to even find the crash. As far as they knew, she was the only survivor. She asked about her mother, and they told her, no, you are the sole survivor. They want to know what happened, and she's, you know, how she survived, all that. So she tells them her story. They in turn tell her about the massive search that had been going on. She explains how she could hear the planes, to which the men were shocked at how close the search party had been to her. And they believed that everyone on board had all died. They told her the next day, after she got some sleep, they would take her to Terna Vista, where someone could give her proper help and medical care that she clearly desperately needed. Julian knew that she was safe, but she still couldn't sleep. Shortly after Julian was found, it was on the front page headline news worldwide. Of course, lies were spread by the press trying to make her story even more sensational, which, I mean, they didn't have to fucking do that.
Right.
Like, the whole thing is, it's amazing just by itself. You don't need to add shit to it. So they were her saying that she had made a makeshift raft, had lived on it for 11 days, that she woke up under three other dead bodies. Times had actually gave a fake quote from Julian saying that she had said, quote, I felt a sensation of emptiness, but I don't remember anything else until I woke up on the ground with three bodies on top. She didn't say that. That is all false. So in the days of her rescue, the press began to turn on.
Of course.
They began to say that she ran away from injured passengers who could have been helped. That is false. Thankfully, for the majority of people, they celebrated her in the fact that she had been found alive. In order for Julian to return to civilization and get her help, the three men traveled for 11 hours by boat. Once they arrived in Terna Vista, she was taken to a hospital, where she got the much-needed medical attention, including medicine for various infections that she had. They then flew her.
Oh, no, no.
To Yernakulka to get better medical treatment, because there were, like, she desperately needed more than what they could give her. Which she said that she was terrified. I mean, it was 2 weeks since she crashed in a plane. She said she was beyond terrified, but she says she was so exhausted, she had no strength to fight them on it. She was like, fuck it. So they get her to this new hospital where she stays. She's stabilized. If they would have tried to take her any other way, she would have died. Like, literally flying her was the only way to get her stable and keep her alive. She spent months in that medical facility. And by the following March, she was back in Lima and back at school. She was back to her normal life, except for the press. They were nightmares. They hounded her day and night, refusing to leave her alone. Her father, Hans, had actually sent her to Germany for some time to get her away from it. Here, she lived with her grandmother and her aunt. Julian said that her father had good intentions by sending her there, but in a way, she felt as if he had betrayed her because of the state that she was in. She said by being sent away, it made her feel abandoned in a way, but those weren't his intentions. And she knew that. Today, Julian still has respect for her parents and she loves them both. She has nothing bad to say about either. In this situation, nobody would know how to handle it. Mm. He just lost his wife. His daughter was just through this massive traumatic thing. Like, how do you deal with all of that? And then it's kind of, you know, you're looking at, she survived, but my wife didn't. You know what I mean? That's a sticky situation to be in. So in 1974, Hans left Peru for Germany. Everyone that knew him said after the crash and the loss of his wife, he was never the same. Hans died in 2000 at the age of 87. Julian said the relationship she had with her dad had changed after everything that happened, that it never really fully recovered, and she understood why. Later, Julian would learn that she was the sole survivor of the crash. That when the site was later found, thanks to Julian leading them there to where she landed and where she had found the turbine from the plane, they had discovered the bodies of every other passenger, and they were able to bring them home. They found evidence that at least 17 passengers had survived the initial crash. But because of their injuries, they died shortly after hitting the jungle floor. One of those initial survivors was Maria, yeah. Julian's mom. But she was nowhere near Julian, and she never would have found her on her own. Julian said when she learned this, it crushed her knowing that her mom did survive initially. And no matter what she did, she would have never been able to get to her.
That's sad.
So, of course, an investigation is done.
Right.
The fuck happened? So the investigation told them that the pilot in the plane was under a ton of pressure to keep on schedule because things had fallen behind before the holiday. So instead of diverting around the storm or landing into a path, as they should have, they went right through it. The plane, despite how it looked, was in terrible shape. Because like I said before, it was built from parts of decommissioned plane. Lanta Airlines was shut down after this.
Good. They should have been shut down before this.
Yeah. So now for a decade, Julian did not return to Peru. At this point, she was a PhD student and had the opportunity to study Amazonia bats in Panguana, which is where she lived with her parents as a child, and where she learned the skills that ultimately led to her survival after the crash. And she took that opportunity. And she spent 18 months there finishing her dissertation.
Wow.
In the 1990s, she returned to the crash site with director Werner Herzog, who was supposed to be on Lanza Flight 508 with his film crew. But because of the chaos at the airport, he decided not to fly. Could you imagine being like, I was supposed to be on that plane?
Right.
Yeah, it's just straight through.
Right there.
She said this return is what made her realize how bad she wanted to return to the jungle and how she wanted to preserve her parents' legacy. She said this was when it hit her, that quote, the jungle caught me. It saved me. It was not its fault that I landed here. After her father died in 2000, Julian became the director of Panguana. In 1999, director Werner filmed and released a documentary called Wings of Hope. In it, he traveled to the crash site with Julian. They walked the crash site, visit where she was rescued, and all of her stops along the way. She tells her story and about all the emotions she felt, her pain and numbness, the times she thought she couldn't go on any longer. She talks about how the loneliness and isolation are unmatched to anything else. As they go through, she stops sometimes picking up pieces of the plane that are still scattered around the jungle today.
Oh, wow.
They visit Pocops, where in a cemetery, many of the passengers that died on Flight 508 are buried. There sits a big memorial with the graves all around it. There's a map inside the memorial that traces with a dotted line that leads from the crash to Terna Vista, where Julian was healed. Under the memorial, it reads, A Lost Day in Esperanza, or Wings of Hope. All 71 passengers and all six crew of the plane's crew died in the crash, with only Julian surviving. Today, Julian is married. She lives in Munich and works as a librarian at the Bavarian State Collection of Zoology in Panguana. She spent decades in Penguina building it up and making the facility and institute larger. It's really more like a conservation now than an institute. And that's it. That is Julian Koepka and her free fall to the jungle and how she survived it.
That was a good one. She went through hell.
I told you it was a good one.
I would have gave up. There's no way.
I would have been dead when I hit the ground.
Yeah, it would have been a wrap for me.
Been a minute.
Yeah, I couldn't have went.
I would have done by the biggest spider, by the biggest animal.
No, I would have died going through the down, coming down from the plane.
Yeah, I would have had an aneurysm and died.
Yeah, it would.
Then if I lived through that, I would have had an aneurysm, a heart attack, and died from that big ass spider.
She's strong. She's badass.
Oh yeah,
she's definitely badass. Yeah.
Be alive and tell your story.
Yeah, and to go on through all that.
She gets back on a plane.
Yeah, and then still injured, went through all that. And then you get back on a plane 11 days, 12 days after you
just went. And she still flies today.
Yeah, no, I'm good. You can have that.
That's all I'm saying. She fell out of the sky 10,000 feet through a thunderstorm.
Yeah.
And she still got back on a plane.
No, I'm good. I'm cool. No way in hell.
Your life don't look that bad now, does it?
Sure in hell don't. But I bet you now I ain't going nowhere unless I can drive.
Oh, yeah.
Next time you complain.
Right.
Think about Julian.
And this is why I'm scared of heights and shit. This bullshit right here. No, I'm good. Hey, it rained outside. Now we're talking about storm.
Okay, so next month our cases are a little.
They're going to be rough.
They're a little rough.
Yeah.
Yep.
That, the kids one, right? Next month?
Yep, because May 25th is Missing Children's Day. So each week next month, we're going to cover a missing children's case. It's going to be hard, but they're important. Something that should be brought awareness to. I have two where the missing child was found. They were returned home safely, and two where they were not. Because in most cases, they're not found.
Right.
So our first case, I'm going to start with one where they're found. Try to start on a good note of sorts, if you want to call it that. Then we're going to go into, you know, we're going to have some statistics and like all that that I normally have for you.
Right.
Then we'll go from there. And then on the 26th, I might cover two different cases. Haven't exactly decided yet if I'm just going to cover the one or if we're going to do two. That episode, I haven't. We still got stuff. I haven't quite decided that yet. But that one's going to be a double abduction, an official. Yep. We'll dive into all that stuff, which those are rare, by the way.
I bet. I bet they are.
Yeah.
They're harder.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I think that's it. You got anything else?
No. That was a good one. I like that one.
That's it.
Good to go.
Our next one will be it'll end on a good note.
I hope so.
We'll be back next week for another episode. As always, I got a few photos for this one, not a whole lot, that'll be on the Facebook page. That's going to be in the episode description. Give us a rate, a review. Don't forget to subscribe so you get new notifications. And then we hope you keep listening. And remember to
watch for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.